This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I've heard many songs about murder over the years, folk ballads, country songs, arias. But I think singer-songwriter Alison Moorer's song, Cold, Cold Earth, is the first murder ballad I've heard where the singer actually witnessed the crime. Moorer was 14 when she heard the gunshots her father fired, killing her mother and then himself, leaving Alison and her 17-year-old sister orphaned. Her sister, Shelby Lynn, is also a singer-songwriter. The murder-suicide is a subject Moorer has tried to avoid talking about in public until now. Her new memoir, Blood, is about growing up in Alabama, witnessing her parents' dysfunctional marriage, and watching her father's rages in which he would beat a dog or Allison's mother or sister. The good part of her childhood was the music. Her mother sang, her father played in local bands and wrote some songs she later discovered, one of which she performs on her new album. Moorer and her sister won awards for their duets when they were children. Moorer's new album is a companion to her memoir and is also called Blood. Alison Moorer's music has been nominated for an Oscar, a Grammy, and an Academy of Country Music Award. As you can probably tell, this interview will have stories related to depression, domestic abuse, murder, and suicide. Alison Moorer brought her guitar to the studio, and she'll sing some songs for us a little later. But first, I want to play a track from her new album, the song about the murder-suicide, called Cold, Cold Earth. We'll start with the second verse.
A slave to the bottle, he driven his family to leave.
Alison Moorer, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your new memoir and on this wonderful new record. You know, there's a great tradition of murder ballads in folk music, but this is a murder ballad you wrote about your own parents. I want you to tell the story through your memoir and read an excerpt of the memoir from the morning of the murder. And you were sleeping in the living room on the floor because your mother had left your father and moved with you and your sister to a rental apartment. She had served him divorce papers. He wanted back into the family. And your mother and her best friend Carolyn were concerned that he might do something dangerous. So she, Carolyn, the friend, was sleeping in your bed, which is why you were sleeping in the living room floor. So if you could read an excerpt from the beginning of your book in which you describe your perception of the murder-suicide?
I think it was around 5 a.m. when the gunshots woke me. There were two. They came very close to one another. Imagine the sound of a .30-06 rifle firing, and then think of the time it takes to snap your fingers four times to the tempo of 13 by Big Star. Then imagine it firing again. I lay there for what feels now like a few minutes, terrified to move even a centimeter or even to breathe. My eyes darted around the barely lit living room for a clue about what to do. I knew without question what I'd heard, the unmistakable sound that takes a life. But I couldn't quite comprehend that I'd heard that sound coming from the front yard that was just on the other side of the living room wall. I was only a few feet away. I wondered if it could have been thunder left over from the storm that came the day before, or maybe another one coming. I wondered if it could have been something else that might imitate the vibrations from a cannon. No. I knew it wasn't anything but what I knew it was. I'd been close enough to guns to recognize exactly the sound they make. A pop, but a little longer than a pop. A burst, violent and hard, then the reverberation. I told myself no, it couldn't be what I knew it was, even as I simultaneously started rearranging every cell in my body to start accepting that yes, it was. Yes, I knew that it was. I got up off the floor where I'd slept and shook myself to the kitchen door. I was 14 years old. I opened the door, which opened onto a carport, and called out into the thick early morning for Mama. Mama? I didn't turn my head to the left, where I knew they probably were, and the darkness was merciful enough to give me no peripheral vision. I just stared straight ahead as I called her one time and not again. I knew there was no need to repeat myself, and I wasn't surprised when there was no response. I couldn't step outside. I turned around to go back to the living room and met Sissy and Carolyn headed in my direction. Carolyn said something about hearing what she thought might have been a gun and that she'd looked into Mama's bedroom and it was empty. I knew Mama wasn't in her bedroom. I knew she was outside, though I hadn't confirmed it with my eyes. Sissy did. She walked straight out the front door into the approaching morning. She then walked back inside. Carolyn, keep Allison in the house. It's Mama and Daddy. I'm going to go get help.
And that's Allison Mora reading from her new memoir, which is called Blood. You know, one of the really just horrible things in terms of what your father did is he didn't think about you and your sister at all. I mean, he shot your mother and killed her and then killed himself. That's horrible enough. But he left two orphans behind. And he left you both with the most traumatic memories. And that strikes me as being so selfish. I mean, obvious, selfish is a very underwhelming word to use here, but it does it trouble you how little he thought about you when he did this horrific action?
I'm pretty sure he did not live his life as a person who never thought about us. I know that he did. I also know that he made many of his decisions with seemingly no regard for his family. He was sick. He was quite possibly mentally ill. I think it's safe to say that this decision was not one that was made with a clear head. His, you know, that's one of the reasons why I got the autopsy reports. I wanted to see what his alcohol level was. And that's not to say that if he had been sober, he wouldn't have made the same decision, because I think he did just break at this point. So I don't know if this was something that he had thought out. He did carry a gun in his van all the time. He kept it under a bean bag that my mama had actually made for him to have in this van that he liked so much. So how she got out there with him, I don't know. And she, you know, she told my sister and me a couple months before this happened that on several occasions he had begged her to shoot him and put the gun in his hand so that it would look like a suicide.
You know, you write in your book that living life afraid, and you were afraid of your father, and your mother and your sister were afraid of him too. One thing we can say about your father that's positive is that he loved music, and he so much wanted to be a songwriter and a professional musician. He had bands that he played in, but I mean, they didn't go anywhere, as they played, you know, local places. And he had to have day jobs, or sometimes he was just unemployed. But he loved music, and he had reel-to-reel tape recorder, and would tape the family singing, would tape you and your sister singing when you were young. And you have a briefcase in which he collected some of the lyrics that he'd written and some of those recordings that he made of the family. And there's a song that you sing on the new album that's a lyric he wrote and a melody that your sister Shelby Lynn wrote for the song. And I want to play the song from the recording, because I'm just not sure you could ever top the version on the recording. It just seems perfect to me. But tell us a little bit about the origin of this song and what it says to you about your father. And I should preface this by saying it has a very telling title, I'm the One to Blame.
Right. Yeah. Shortly after they died, my sister found this lyric in an old briefcase of his. And he would have been 25 or 6 when he wrote it. Yeah, just the title alone, I'm the One to Blame. The lyric is, I'm the one to blame, I've paid the cost. Time has made me see just how much I've lost. Jealousy and pride drove me to shame. I'm so sorry, dear, but I'm the one to blame. Sorrow took the pride, I'll take the blame. That's the line that blows me away.
Why is that the line?
Sorrow took the pride, I'll take the blame. Because it reveals such a sadness and such a, just, that is just a despondent line. And it reveals so much. And you know, I have no idea what his intentions were for this song. I never heard him sing it. I have no recollection of the song at all. So to find it after he died was just, it shook us to the core. But, you know, in typical survivor fashion, my sister thought, that's pretty good. I think I'll put music to it. And she did. And she did, and she put great music to it. Neither of us have ever recorded it, but I thought this album was a perfect opportunity to do so. I wanted him to have a voice. I wanted to say, finally, here you go, Daddy. You get to be heard.
So let's hear the song with your father's lyric and your sister's melody. I'm the One to Blame. This is from Alison Moorer's new album, Blood.
I'm the one to blame. I paid the cost. Time has made me see just how much I lost. Jealousy and pride drove me to shame, and I'm so sorry, dear, but I'm the one to blame. Sorrow took the pride, take the hurt away, and take me back again, only to time will tell. I will get along. Oh, love is not the same. Once the trust is gone, but I do my best if you and forgive me, my love, 'cause I'm the one to blame.
I just think that is such a sad song, and your version of it just, I get chills when I listen to it. It's really, it's so emotional. You say that he was jealous of your mother's talent, like your mother was a natural singer, and you and your sister just grew up knowing how to sing harmony, and you both have great voices. But your father had to work on it, and he never, you know, he's the one who really, he wanted to be a professional and wasn't. Do you think jealousy of your mother's talent figured into his anger at her?
I do. And I will say that my mother had a leg up. She was raised in a very musical family. Her mama was one of 14 children. She was born in 1926, so that was in the Great Depression, and they didn't have much to do to entertain themselves but sing and play music. So my grandparents would have what we called fiddlings at their house, and we would often join in, and everybody just knew. Everybody on my mama's side of the family, most of them, just knew how to sing and play and sit around and at least play three or four chords on the guitar and know how to hear a harmony part. And it was just it was a way of life. Music on my mama's side of the family was just a given. Somebody came over in the afternoon for a piece of pie and a cup of coffee, as they often did. They would end up picking out a tune on the guitar or the piano, and just it was just always around. My daddy did not have that experience. His parents were not musical. So maybe he didn't have a chance to develop as great an ear as she had. Maybe. I don't know. There was a lot of natural talent in my mother. She had a great voice. She had great rhythm. She had a great ear. Daddy had to work very much harder at just being okay. And I do, like, his rhythm wasn't very good. And, you know, he wasn't someone who could really sing harmony that well.
Yeah.
I have a tape of the two of them singing together, of Mom and Daddy singing together. And he all of a sudden changes the key. And she whispers to him, "You changed the key." And he corrected himself, but the tape cuts off very quickly. And I thought, oh, God, I wonder what price she had to pay for correcting him, because he hated to be corrected.
I want to end with a song that you do on your new album, Blood, and it's called Heal. And it's the last song on the album, and it's kind of like a prayer.
It's an absolute prayer. It's a plea.
Yeah. Who are you praying to?
God.
I was unclear whether you had any belief left in God.
I absolutely believe in God.
Okay.
And I believe in God more now than I've ever believed in God. I wrote in this memoir this prayer I used to pray, "Please God, don't let Daddy hurt Mama." And I would pray it and pray it and pray it, in mostly at night, waiting on her to come tuck us in. "Please God, don't let Daddy hurt Mama," because what we heard indicated that he would. And I also say that I didn't pray for a long time after they died. And that, I don't know what that means, other than maybe I thought it was useless. I was too angry. I was not in a place where I felt close to my own spirit. But as I've gotten older, I've realized what an important part of life that is, to have a relationship with your spiritual self. And what a comfort that is, because having faith that life unfolds as it should, whether we agree or not with the way it unfolds, is a source of peace and comfort.
Alison Moore, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Terry Gross.
No matter how I try, I end up on the ground. Another orphan waiting in the lost and found. Over and over, I take it on the chin. Fists up to the world, fighting a fight I cannot win. Help me lay my weapons down. Help me give the love I feel. Help me hold myself with kindness. Help me heal.
That's Alison Moorer from her new album, Blood. Now our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, has a review of a new box set of early recordings by the pianist and singer Nat King Cole, covering the years 1936 to 1943. It's one of several tribute collections released this year, celebrating the centennial of his birth.
We'll call it spots, I know them, where music is really low down. And just for fun, we'll show them how we can go to town. I love to circulate when you my heavy babe. So come on, honey, don't make me wait. Let's do new things.
Nat King Cole in 1940. Later in his career as one of the great 20th century pop singers, publicists sold the idea that the pianist had only reluctantly backed into singing. See, for example, a short biopic where he plays himself, the Nat King Cole musical story, which you can find online. To be sure, he was a formidable pianist who'd come up in Earl Hines's Chicago. Early on, and sometimes later, he could catch Hines's blend of antic action and pinpoint timing. Here's Cole on his first record date, Chicago, 1936. Nat Cole's career didn't really get going till a couple of years later, after he'd moved to Los Angeles. He formed a trio with guitarist Oscar Moore and bassist Wesley Prince, the band that put Cole over and where he sang from the first. Harmony vocals were as central to the trio's act as the hot instrumental work, which very much included Oscar Moore's guitar solos.
Now you really got the ways and means. It's good from North Dakota to New Orleans. If you want to get back to your teens, let's get happy tonight. La la la, do da do da do da do da. Ra do la do de, ra do la do de, ra do do la de.
Nat King Cole Trio in 1939, before Oscar Moore switched to electric guitar. This music's from a 7-CD roundup of stuff Cole recorded before signing with Capitol Records, where he became a star. It's called Hittin' the Ramp, the early years, 1936 to 1943, from the Resonance label. Almost all the music is by the Cole Trio, but there are a couple of small groups with top tenor saxophonists, Lester Young or this one, Dexter Gordon. Thank you. Most of the trio music in the box Hitting the Ramp comes from so-called transcription recordings, which were made for radio stations, short performances broadcasters used to plug holes in programming. For the musicians involved, squeezing all the action into less than 3 minutes was good training for making pop records, and it encouraged springy solos. Trio fit Nat King Cole like a tux. Oscar Moore's rhythm was so solid, they didn't need a drummer. Over the years, the piano guitar bass lineup was copied by, among others, Art Tatum, Oscar Peterson, Ahmad Jamal, and singing pianist Diana Krall. Its influence went further. Pianist Errol Garner's left hand could mimic strummed guitar under his right hand block chords, like he wanted to be Oscar Moore and Nat Cole at the same time. You can hear Garner's style coming in Cole's 1939 You're My Life. By the time the Nat Cole Trio began knocking out hits for Capitol late in 1943, they were ready to break through. They'd been polishing their repertoire on gigs and radio shows during a long hiatus in recording owing to a standoff between the musicians' union and the record companies. That's when the trio honed favorites like Straighten Up and Fly Right and Sweet Lorraine. Once Cole became a singing star, he moved away from the piano. He'd get back to it sometimes, if not often enough for jazz fans. Fair enough. He sure could sing, though.
Now I've just found joy. I'm as happy as a baby boy with another brand new choo-choo toy. When I met my sweet Lorraine.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and The Audio Beat. He reviewed Nat King Cole, Hittin' the Ramp, the early years, 1936 to 1943, a 7-CD reissue of his early recordings. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Saeed Jones, has written a new memoir called How We Fight for Our Lives. It's about growing up black, gay, and closeted in Texas in the 90s when he thought gay meant AIDS meant death. The book is a coming-of-age memoir, but our book critic Maureen Corrigan says Jones's voice and sensibility are so distinct that he turns one of the oldest literary genres inside out and upside down. Maureen also describes the memoir as raw and eloquent. The book includes descriptions of his early experiences hooking up with men and sometimes putting himself in risky situations. When he got to college, he came out and found other gay young men who were out. He went to the University of Western Kentucky on a debating scholarship. He had also gotten a scholarship to NYU, but it didn't cover all the tuition, and he and his single mother couldn't afford to pay the remainder. Saeed Jones's memoir won the Kirkus Prize for nonfiction. His collection of poems, Prelude to Bruise, was nominated for a National Book Critics Circle Award and received a Penn Award and a Stonewall Book Award. He's the former LGBT editor and culture editor of BuzzFeed. Saeed Jones, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start in the library, not just because you're a writer, but because the library is where you first went to get answers to your questions about homosexuality. So before you do the reading, I just want to set it up a little bit. You'd been reading James Baldwin's Another Country, which had two significances for you. One was the content of the book, and the other was the photo in the book. So tell us a little bit about both, which will lead into the reading.
Sure, yeah. My mom didn't graduate from college. She grew up in Memphis, Tennessee. She went to, a state school there for a few semesters. But she kept her books. And among them were, copies of books by Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, James Baldwin. And by the time I'm 12, as you see in the opening chapter of my memoir, I start gravitating towards those books because they're in the middle of our living room. And I pick up her copy of Another Country, and I'm immediately pulled in by the language, the setting in Harlem. It's sexy. It's invoking jazz, and it feels like jazz as I'm reading it. And, there are interracial relationships. There's queerness. There's bisexuality. A lot of fluidity, a lot of back and forth with all of the characters. But also, I found a Polaroid photograph of my mom and this man, this young man that I didn't know, that was dated Jackson, Mississippi, 1982. And so I asked my mom about it when she got home from work that day, and my mom was a bit terse. She held her cards close to her chest when it came to life stories. And she just eventually kind of admitted that, that was a friend of hers. They were close when they were college students. They would take road trips. And then she just kind of went on and then quickly just threw off that, and later he found out that he was sick and killed himself. And I'm like, wait, what? Like that, huh? And then she just quickly said AIDS and walked out of the room. And my mom and I never actually talked about that man, that photograph, or what we learned about each other that day ever again, ever.
So what year are we talking about?
This is May 1998. So, Matthew Shepard is going to be killed that October, which also figures into the book.
So I want you to read a short scene from the book. Sure. In which you are in the library looking for some information about what it means to be gay, because you've got nobody to talk to about it.
I've got no one to talk to, and I'm afraid to ask questions. Like, I'm afraid to even go to the librarian to ask for context, so I'm just figuring it out on my own. The first book that stopped me was for parents dealing with gay children. The introduction was worded like it was intended for readers coping with a late-stage cancer diagnosis. I put the book back on the shelf, wrong side out. Eventually, I gathered 5 or 6 books and sat down on the floor with them in my lap. Like any teenage boy trained at reading things he should not be, I looked both ways before opening any, then got up and grabbed a decoy off the shelf. It was a book about the sociology of boys. I kept it open on the second chapter and within reach in case someone I knew came down the aisle and I needed a quick alibi. All the books I found about being gay were also about AIDS. Gay men dying of AIDS like it was a logical sequence of events, a mathematical formula, or a life cycle. Caterpillar, cocoon, butterfly. Gay boy, gay man, AIDS. It was certain. Mom's friend got AIDS because he was gay. Because he was gay, he killed himself. Because he knew he was dying anyway. I read about gay men who were abandoned by their families when they came out, or worse, who did not tell anyone that they were gay, even when lesions started to blossom on their skin like awful flowers. Either way, the men in those books always seemed to die alone. I took some comfort in the fact that Mom knew about her friend's illness. Maybe he had been able to tell the people close to him. Maybe Mom was the kind of person you could tell. When I stood up to put the books back on the shelf, I realized my hands were shaking. I felt like I had made the mistake of asking a fortune teller to look into my future, and now I was being punished for trying to look too far ahead.
And that's Saeed Jones reading from his new memoir. So was sex and death equated in your mind?
Absolutely. And I think, this is true for my generation. I'm 33 years old. I was born in 1985. And I would say until, frankly, the last, 2 or 3 years with the introduction of PrEP, Truvada, most gay men, a defining aspect of our sexual experiences has been an awareness of not just, STIs, STDs, that we all need to be aware of and thoughtful about, but am I going to get HIV, AIDS, right? Which, is no longer a death sentence as I understood it at the time. But certainly, I mean, that is a lifelong condition that's going to require treatment and support, and that there's a heaviness to that. There is a just a deep sense of foreboding that I think often turns into shame with time because it feels like you're risking punishment, You know, and that's why that idea that it's a life cycle, as I perceived it in reading those books as a 12-year-old in 1998, it was just so deeply heartbreaking because, you know, I had so many questions about my life and my future, you know, that idea of trying to look too far ahead. But the one question I never had was like, am I attracted to men? You know, I knew that this attraction was sincere and reasonable and just a part of who I am, you know. So the questions that I was trying to figure out were like, am I doomed because of who I am?
Well, you know, you're right. Being black can get you killed. Being mm-hmm. gay can get you killed. Being a black gay boy is a death wish.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, 1998 is so pivotal. You know, James Byrd Jr., a black man who lived just 4 hours from where we were living at the time in Louisville, he accepted a ride home from three men who turned out to be white supremacists. He just needed a ride home. He couldn't afford it. And they ended up beating him up and chaining him to the back of their truck and dragging him for miles until his body was literally dismembered. It just came apart. And I remember this summer... You know, being 12 years old and sitting on the couch with my mom, a black single parent, and watching this. And then that fall, that October, you know, again, watching the news, hearing the kind of public conversation, you know, I learn about the name Matthew Shepard, who was killed in Laramie, Wyoming, by two men he meets at a bar one night. And so, yeah, I mean, growing up, I was seeing these cautionary tales connected to identity. And of course, being gay isn't a choice, just like being black isn't a choice. And neither of those things should be cause for shame. And yet, it was just so clear that it was perilous to be a black gay boy in America.
So you grew up in Texas mm-hmm. with a single mother. She had two jobs, so you'd spend part of each summer in Memphis with your grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
Your mother was Buddhist mm-hmm. and chanted Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. And what's the name of the form of Buddhism that she practiced?
She practiced with the Soka Gakkai.
Thank you. And so she taught you to chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo. So you were visiting your grandmother, mm-hmm. who at this point was going to a different church than the one she used to take you to. And there was mm-hmm. a visiting evangelical pastor who was preaching hell and damnation. And one day after the sermon, when people were invited down to the pulpit, your grandmother took you to the pulpit and told the preacher that your mother was Buddhist.
Mm-hmm.
Would you describe the preacher's reaction?
Sure. I'd never spoken to him. He certainly didn't know my mom. But he just like nodded like that was all he needed to know. And he just started praying, really cursing my mother. And it was basically like, you know, God, make her suffer. You know, put all your ailments and plagues on her so she suffers so much that she comes back to the church and brings her son with him. That was the prayer.
Yeah, make her suffer. Put every ailment, every disease on her until she breaks under the weight of the Holy Spirit. Show her your plagues and save this child. And then your grandmother thanked him.
Yeah.
For wishing plagues on her daughter, your mother.
Mm-hmm.
How did you experience that moment?
So viscerally. I remember how hot I felt. I remember that I felt like I was going to faint because I was feeling so many things. My mind was racing. I was thinking about her. I was thinking about my mom. I was thinking about all the people watching us. Am I crying? Do they think I'm crying? It was just my mind was racing. And then when he said her at one point, and then maybe like the make her suffer, I like snapped into focus because I was so distracted that in that moment I was like, wait, you're talking about my mom. Oh my God. You know? And it was just so... sickening that he would do that for so many reasons. And of course, deeply, even now, it just makes me so sad that I think my grandmother really believed she was doing the right thing. I think she thought she was saving her grandson's soul, which is, you know, an act of love. But even in that moment, I knew I was like, this is wrong. This is insanely hurtful and just disturbing. And I couldn't even speak. Neither of us. We didn't really talk, right? And it was like that for years.
Did you ever talk to your grandmother or your mother about that?
I never told my mom about it because I couldn't. I couldn't even imagine telling my mom that her mother had thanked a pastor for praying for her to get sick. I couldn't even. I told my mom that I was like, I'm not going to Memphis by myself anymore. Certainly not for the summer, but like, you know, the holidays or whatever. If you can't go, like, I'm not going to go. And that stayed until she passed away when I was in my 30s. I just wouldn't go by myself. And if I went with her, it was short. My grandma, we didn't really talk about it. She has read the book. And so we've made up and we talk about it in the context of the book, which is to say she read it and she said about that section of the book, she just said it brought back a lot of memories. So, you know, I appreciate that she never was like, don't write about it. Or, you know, she's never tried to like control the story or say, well, you didn't really understand. Like she's just kind of owned it. Which, frankly, I really appreciate because I think the only thing that could have made all of this more hurtful is that if she'd tried to, like, gaslight me.
You know, we talked about how it was hard to talk to your mother about mm-hmm. being gay. So when you did try to, like, come out to her, she probably already knew, but you hadn't officially come out to her. So you tried to do it with a joke.
Right.
A joke that she didn't really get.
Oh, God.
Tell us the joke and how that landed.
I'd gotten a little memento from my speech team to celebrate, you know, the year or whatever. And it was just, and everyone had a little motto. And my motto was, not even his clothes are in the closet anymore, which I thought was very funny. And so I was talking to her about it. And she was just like, what does that mean? And I was like, you know, my clothes aren't in the closet anymore. Like, I'm not in the closet anymore. and she didn't find it funny. She was confused. And she had a lot of follow-up questions. And that's how I ended up coming out to her.
What were her follow-up questions?
She said, have you had a lot of experiences? Like, I don't think at first she would use the word gay. She would just say, have you had a lot of experiences? And I was like, are you talking about being gay? And then she would just repeat the question. And I finally was like, yeah, fine, yes. And then I was like, are you always going to call it experiences? And she was just like, answer the question. And then she was like, are you using protection? And I said, yes. And then that was kind of it. She was kind of like, okay, bye, I got to go. She sounded tired. She sounded really tired. And that was it. And then she called me back later that day when I started freaking out, like, oh, God. Because I felt like I had messed up. Like, this was actually really significant to her. And that I'd been cracking jokes on a moment that I had been wanting for years, right? And so I felt really bad. But then she just called me back and was just like, hey, I forgot to say I love you. And I love you. And you seem happy. And that's all that matters, you know? And that meant the world to me. It was just really important for her mm-hmm. to say that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's another time, and I guess this was earlier. Mm-hmm. We were on a long car drive with your mother, and she brings up the war in Iraq, which is in the news. And mm-hmm. you said you dated a guy whose brother was serving there.
Right.
You know, so you slipped in, you dated a guy.
Yeah, so that was actually later.
That was later?
After I came out to her. Oh. Yeah. Because it was like we went back in the closet. And I think this actually happens with a lot of people. Like, you kind of come out to your family members and they're like, okay, or not. And then sometimes people just try to go back and pretend that it didn't happen. And mm-hmm. that's totally what happened with my mom. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, you're right. She was silent and then she stared mm-hmm. at you almost pleadingly. Mm-hmm. And you're right. I did exactly what I thought all people who love each other do. Mm-hmm. I erased myself so I could be her son again. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people will relate to this, whether they're gay or not, because I think we've all erased ourselves in yeah. some way with our parents so that
totally.
We could continue having a great relationship. But who were you when you erased yourself so you could be her son? Like, what was left that wasn't erased?
That's a beautiful question. I mean, we laughed a lot. We could talk about just about literally anything except my being gay, which began to feel more and more like a void. But, you know, we talked about the news and we would laugh. And, you know, she was so proud of how I was doing in school and as a student and in speech. So we would just talk about everything. But it was only about being gay that she just couldn't handle it. And, you know, Terry, something I've noticed, I think you're right, we all do this. It's kind of like, sometimes straight people or cisgender people act like gay or trans people are being mean by being ourselves. Like, why are you forcing us to have this? Why are you making me do this? You know, I feel like white people act this way when it's about racism. Like, when black people are like, Black Lives Matter, I feel like the reaction sometimes is like, why are you being so mean to me, making me talk, you know? And so it's this weird dynamic where you, again, you're struggling and you end up prioritizing the other person's feelings over your own, you know? And I did it because I loved her. I did it because I felt like I was causing her pain by trying to talk about this. But she was still my mom. I still needed to have her wisdom in terms of love and relationships, you know, and I didn't get it and really struggled as a result.
How did you know that you were a writer?
Because I was good at it. It was the thing that I could always count on to get praised in school. Was always
like dating back to when, like high school?
Middle school was probably the middle school was when I started like really going for it, and then like asking for extra credit and like taking risks and doing more, you know, and then also like in discussions, like in literature discussions about short stories and fiction or whatever, like it all just made so much sense to me. Like I remember learning the narrative arc, like in what, maybe the eighth grade, you know, resolution, climax, and it just made sense. I was like, oh, duh. And I literally had never heard it before, but it just seemed like I was kind of like with queerness. It felt like I was just being given language to explain something I already just understood. I just get it. It's just in me.
Saeed Jones, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for your book.
Thank you, Terry. Thank you.
Saeed Jones' new memoir is called How We Fight for Our Lives.